A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The black coat and fur hat on a man walking down a Tel Aviv street in 35 degree heat. It's not just clothing, it's a uniform that announces, we are not of this place, not of this century. And in July 2026, that statement is getting harder to ignore. The Knesset is once again debating the conscription exemption law for yeshiva students. And here in Jerusalem, weekly protests against a Shabbat open coffee shop have escalated to dumpster fires and physical confrontations. So Daniel sent us this one. He wants to know who the Haredim really are, how far back their movement goes, and whether their claim to be the only authentic expression of religious Judaism holds up under scrutiny. He's also asking the uncomfortable question, when a group brands itself as the most devout Jews in the world, but behaves, in his words, like a mafia. Refusing national service, drawing down state resources, and enforcing their norms through intimidation, what does that say about their version of Judaism? And how does it compare to the ancient Israelites and the religious leadership?
Before we get to the dumpster fires and the Knesset battles, we need to understand who these people actually are, because the answer is more complicated than you think.
So, define the group for us.
Haredi, literally, those who tremble before God, is an umbrella term. It covers Hasidic sects, the Lithuanian-style yeshiva communities, and Sephardic Haredi groups. What unites them is strict adherence to halakha, Jewish law, and a conscious rejection of secular modernity. But internally, they're not a monolith. A Ger Hasid from Jerusalem and a Lithuanian yeshiva student from Bnei Brak have different customs, different leadership structures, sometimes different languages. Yiddish is dominant among Ashkenazi Haredim, but Sephardic Haredim speak Hebrew or Arabic at home.
Here's the thing that trips people up. This group claims to be the most authentic carriers of Jewish tradition, the direct heirs of Sinai. But their distinctive dress, their language, their entire social structure, largely inventions of 19th century Eastern Europe. The black coats aren't from ancient Judea, they're from 18th century Polish nobility.
That's the central paradox. The Haredi self-image is one of unchanging continuity, but the movement as we know it crystallized in reaction to the Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Before that, Jewish communities looked very different, and we'll get to that. But first, the scope. Haredim are currently about 14% of Israel's population. By 2050, they're projected to reach 25%. That's not a guess, it's math. Haredi women average 6.7 children. Secular Jewish women average 3.1.
The fastest growing segment of Israeli society is also the one least invested in the state's institutions. That's the tension we're going to trace. The history, the demographics, and then the three flashpoints: military service, economic burden, and civil disruption.
Let's go back to the beginning. Not to ancient Israel, but to 18th century Lithuania and Ukraine, where the Haredi world was really born.
Set the stage for us.
The Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah, hit Eastern Europe in the late 1700s. It promoted secular education, integration into European society, and a rationalist approach to Jewish texts. For traditional rabbinic leadership, this was an existential threat. Assimilation wasn't a theoretical concern. They were watching communities in Germany and France disappear into secular culture. The response was a hardening of boundaries. Two figures define the poles of this reaction. The Vilna Gaon, Elijah ben Solomon Zalman, lived from 1720 to 1797 in Lithuania. He represented the Mitnardic approach, intense analytical Torah study as the highest ideal, opposition to the emotional mysticism of Hasidism. And then the Baal Shem Tov, who founded Hasidism in the Ukrainian countryside, emphasizing joy, song, and the idea that even simple Jews could access the divine through sincere prayer.
They fought each other bitterly at the time, the Mitnagdim and the Hasidim. But both were responding to the same threat. Secularization and assimilation were the common enemy.
and by the mid-19th century, that shared opposition produced a new kind of Jewish community, one that defined itself by what it rejected. Changes in dress? The use of the vernacular instead of Yiddish? This is when the yeshiva system as we know it was born. The Volozhin Yeshiva, founded in 1803, became the model for full-time Torah study as a lifelong vocation rather than a phase before entering a trade.
The Haredi identity was forged in opposition. That's important. It wasn't a natural evolution of ancient practice. It was a defensive crouch against modernity.
That defensive crouch became a worldview. Now, fast forward to the late 19th century. Theodor Herzl and the early Zionists proposed something radical, a secular Jewish state. For most Haredi leaders, this was not just a political disagreement. It was heresy. The traditional Jewish understanding was that the Jewish people would return to their land only when the Messiah came. A human effort to force redemption was seen as a rebellion against God's plan.
This is where the rupture with Zionism really happens. The secular Zionists were often irreligious, sometimes actively anti-religious. They saw the old rabbinic leadership as a relic of the ghetto. The Haredi leaders saw the Zionists as apostates, who would bring divine punishment on the Jewish people.
The theological case was codified by the Satmar Rebbe, Yoel Teitelbaum, in his 1959 book Vayuel Moshe. He argued from traditional sources that Zionism violated three oaths found in the Talmud. Oaths that forbid the Jewish people from ascending to the land by force, from rebelling against the nations, and from delaying the redemption. For Satmar and groups like Neturei Ikarta and the Ida Hacharitas, the State of Israel is a heretical entity.
Yet, and this is where it gets strange, the vast majority of Haredim in Israel don't actually subscribe to that hardline anti-Zionism. They take state money. Their parties, Shas, United Torah Judaism, sit in coalition governments. They're not Neturei Karta. But the theological discomfort with the state never fully went away.
Which brings us to the deal that set all of this in motion. In 1947, David Ben-Gurion needed political support for the establishment of the state. He negotiated with the Agudat Israel Party, the main Haredi political body at the time. The agreement, 400 yeshiva students would be exempted from military service. The idea was to preserve a small cadre of Torah scholars after the Holocaust had wiped out the great yeshivas of Europe.
A temporary gesture of respect, essentially.
That was the intent. By 2025, annual exemptions exceeded 66,000, that is, a 165-fold increase. The original deal never anticipated anything close to this. And in 2024, the High Court of Justice struck down the exemption law as unconstitutional, ruling that it violated the principle of equality before the law. That ruling triggered the current legislative crisis. The Knesset is now trying to pass a new law that would essentially enshrine the exemption permanently.
How did a temporary exemption for 400 become a permanent entitlement for tens of thousands?
Haredi parties have been kingmakers in Israeli coalition governments for decades. They don't care about foreign policy or economic reform. They care about funding for yeshivas and the exemption. Any prime minister who wants to form a government has to give them what they want. The price of coalition has been the exemption, and the price keeps going up because the population keeps growing.
The population keeps growing because of that fertility rate, 6.7 children per woman. That's not just a demographic curiosity. It's a deliberate strategy. More children means more political power, more state subsidies, and a larger base for the yeshiva system.
It's working. The Israel Democracy Institute projects Haredim will be a quarter of the population by 2050. That's a ticking time bomb for the state budget and for the social contract. Because here's the thing, the Haredi community is not just growing. It's structurally opting out of the economy and national service while drawing disproportionately on state resources.
That's the history. But history doesn't pay the bills or decide who serves in the army. Let's talk about the present, and it's not pretty.
Let's start with the economic asymmetry. Haredi men have a labor force participation rate of about 52% compared to roughly 88% for non-Haredi Jewish men, and those who do work earn about 40% less on average. Because the yeshiva system provides almost no secular education. Math, science, English, these are not taught beyond a bare minimum, if at all. So you have a population of men in their 20s and 30s who've spent their entire lives studying Talmud, which is intellectually rigorous but doesn't translate to most jobs in a modern economy.
It's not like they're just choosing not to work. The system is set up to make leaving difficult. Full-time Torah study is valorized as the highest calling. A man who leaves the yeshiva to get a job is often seen as a failure, someone who couldn't cut it.
It's a structural trap. Meanwhile, Haredi families receive disproportionate state subsidies, child allowances, housing grants, yeshiva stipends. The state effectively funds non-participation. A Haredi family with 6 or 7 children receives far more in child allowances than a secular family with 2 children. And the yeshiva stipends, while modest individually, add up to billions of shekels annually when you're funding tens of thousands of students.
The model is high birth rate, low workforce participation, heavy reliance on state transfers. That's not sustainable even at 14% of the population. At 25%, it breaks the budget.
It's already causing resentment. A 2023 survey by the Israel Democracy Institute found that over 70% of non-Haredi Jewish Israelis believe the exemption is unfair. That number has been rising. You can feel it in the public discourse. There's a growing sense that there are 2 different social contracts, one for Haredim and one for everyone else.
Then there's the civil disruption, the Shabbat wars, the modesty patrols, the dumpster fires. Let's talk about what's happening on the ground.
The coffee shop protests in Jerusalem's Nahlaut neighborhood are a perfect microcosm. A new coffee shop opens and decides to operate on Shabbat. Within weeks, Haredi protesters are gathering outside every Friday night and Saturday. They block the entrance. They burn dumpsters in the street. They physically intimidate customers, shouting, shoving, sometimes worse. The police response has been inconsistent. Sometimes they arrest protesters. Sometimes they stand aside and let it happen. The message that sends is corrosive. The law depends on who's breaking it.
This isn't about one coffee shop. It's about who controls public space in a mixed city. Nahlaut is not a Haredi neighborhood. It's a mixed area with secular, religious, and Haredi residents. But the protests are designed to make secular life impossible. If you can't open a business on Shabbat without facing weekly mobs, eventually you'll close. That's the goal.
The tactics go beyond protests. Haredi communities maintain internal order through what are euphemistically called modesty patrols, self-appointed enforcers who police dress codes, gender separation, and religious observance. In extreme cases, there have been arson attacks. In 2023, a Haredi extremist set fire to a Jerusalem LGBT center. Businesses that violate Shabbat or sell non-kosher food have been targeted. The state often looks the other way, treating these as internal community matters rather than crimes.
Then there's the light rail. The Jerusalem light rail was supposed to connect the city, a modern transit system for everyone. Haredi protests over its operation on Shabbat, and the route alignment through Mia Sharim cost 600 million shekels in damage and delayed the project by 2 years. 600 million shekels of public money gone because a community that doesn't use the light rail on Shabbat decided no one else should either.
The protests involved physical attacks on construction crews, vandalism of equipment, and mass disruptions. Again, the police response was inconsistent. The project eventually went forward, but the cost overruns and delays were borne by every Israeli taxpayer.
You have a community that doesn't serve in the army, doesn't participate fully in the economy, draws heavily on state resources, and uses intimidation tactics to impose its norms on public space. It's not hard to see why even traditionally religious Israelis are starting to view this as an internal enemy situation.
Yet the anti-Zionist paradox is even stranger. Groups like Neturei Karta openly fly Palestinian flags. They've attended Holocaust denial conferences in Iran. They embrace figures who call for Israel's destruction. But they live in Jerusalem. They receive Israeli welfare. They use Israeli hospitals. They rely on the IDF to keep the border secure, even as they denounce the state that fields that army.
Now, a lot of people call that hypocrisy. I think that misses the point. It's not hypocrisy. It's a coherent theological position, just one that most Israelis find incomprehensible. The view is, the state of Israel is a temporary, illegitimate entity that will be swept away when the Messiah comes. In the meantime, we are compelled to live here because this is the Holy Land, and we will take whatever resources the illegitimate state offers us because those resources rightfully belong to the Jewish people anyway. It's internally consistent. It's also, from the perspective of anyone who serves and pays taxes, infuriating.
This is where the biblical counterpoint gets really sharp. Daniel raised this in his prompt. How does Haredi behavior compare to the ancient Israelites and their religious leadership? And the answer is, not well.
Walk us through it.
The biblical prophets, Amos, Isaiah, Micah, spent a huge portion of their energy criticizing the religious establishment of their day. And what were they criticizing? The prioritization of ritual purity over justice. Empty sacrifices while ignoring the poor. Fasting while oppressing workers. Amos chapter 5, verses 21 to 24. I hate, I despise your festivals. Take away from me the noise of your songs. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream.
That's a direct attack on religious performance without moral substance. And the prophets were not gentle about it.
Not at all. Isaiah chapter 1 has God saying, He's sick of burnt offerings and new moons and Sabbaths. The very rituals the religious leaders were most punctilious about, because their hands were full of blood and they weren't defending the orphan and the widow. The prophetic tradition is relentless on this point. Ritual observance without justice is an abomination.
Ancient Judaism was a national religion. It was tied to the land, to the Hebrew language, to collective defense. The idea of a separatist sect that refuses to participate in national defense while claiming to be the most authentic Jews? The biblical Israelites would have found that incomprehensible. When Nehemiah rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem, the builders worked with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. They didn't say, "We'll pray while you fight."
The ancient Israelite model was an integrated one. Religious life and national life were the same thing. The king was anointed by a prophet, the army was mustered with religious ritual, the land was divided by tribe. There was no concept of opting out of collective responsibility while claiming spiritual superiority. That idea is a modern invention.
The rabbinic tradition that came after the destruction of the temple, the Talmud itself, is full of debates about the balance between study and action, between personal piety and communal obligation. The idea that full-time Torah study for all men is the highest ideal. That's not a consensus position in Jewish tradition. It's a specific, historically contingent development.
The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot is explicit. If there is no flour, there is no Torah. Meaning, you need to work. You need to eat. The ideal was combining Torah study with a profession. Maimonides, the greatest Jewish philosopher of the medieval period, was a physician. Rashi, the foundational biblical commentator, was a winemaker. The model of the kollel full-time study for married men supported by community funds existed but was rare and small scale. The mass yeshiva system we see today is a post-Holocaust phenomenon heavily subsidized by the Israeli state.
The Haredi claim to be the only authentic expression of religious Judaism is historically weak. Their distinctive practices are largely 19th century innovations. Their anti-Zionist theology is a minority position even within Judaism, and their model of mass non-participation in the economy and national defense has no precedent in ancient Israel or in most of Jewish history.
That's before we even get to the internal diversity. Not all Haredim are the same. There's a growing movement of Haredi women entering the workforce, often in tech, actually. There's the Netzah Yehuda Battalion, a combat unit designed for Haredi men who want to serve in the IDF while maintaining religious standards. There are internal critics who argue the community has lost its way, that the original ideal of Torah study has become a political racket.
Those voices are still marginal. The leadership, the rabbinical councils, and the political parties have strong incentives to maintain the status quo. The rabbis get power and prestige. The politicians get budgets and ministries. The rank-and-file Haredi family often lives in poverty, with the father in kollel and the mother working a low-wage job while raising 6 or 7 children. They might prefer a different path, but the system makes it nearly impossible to choose one.
Where does this leave us? We've got a community that's growing fast, opting out of national service, and increasingly clashing with the state. Here's what I think it means.
The first thing to understand is that the Haredi phenomenon is not a relic of ancient Judaism. It's a modern reaction to modernity. Once you see that, the claim to be the only authentic Jews collapses. They're one expression of Judaism among many, a particularly intense and insular one, shaped by specific historical circumstances. That doesn't make them illegitimate. but it does mean their demands for special treatment can't be justified by appeals to tradition.
Second, the demographic math is inexorable. At 25% of the population, the current model of exemption and subsidy is fiscally unsustainable. Something will have to give. Either the state will force integration, through mandatory secular education, through ending the exemption, through cutting subsidies, or the economic burden on the productive population will become unbearable. There's no third option.
Third, for listeners trying to make sense of Haredi news, the protests, the political demands, the clashes with police, ask who benefits. The rabbinical leadership and the political parties have strong incentives to keep the community isolated and dependent. The rank-and-file Haredi family isn't the enemy. They're often trapped in a system they didn't design and can't easily leave.
The real question isn't, are Haredim good Jews? That's a theological question, and we're not in the business of answering it. The real question is, can a modern state accommodate a community that rejects its basic premises? That's a tension every pluralistic society faces, but Israel faces it in an acute form because the rejecting community is growing so fast and wielding so much political power.
This isn't just an Israeli question. Every liberal democracy is wrestling with how to handle illiberal minority groups that use the freedoms of the system to undermine it. The Haredi case is a particularly vivid example because the numbers are so stark and the consequences so immediate.
What happens when the Haredi birth rate meets a shrinking state budget? The current coalition government is held hostage by Haredi parties. They can bring down any government that crosses them. But demographic pressure may force a reckoning within a decade. You can't run a modern economy when a quarter of your population isn't participating in it.
The story isn't over. There are cracks in the wall. Haredi women are entering the workforce in growing numbers. They're often better educated than Haredi men, because girls' schools teach some secular subjects. The Netzer Yehuda Battalion has shown that Haredi men can serve in combat roles while maintaining religious observance. There are Haredi tech entrepreneurs, Haredi academics, Haredi activists pushing for reform from within. The community is not a monolith, and it's not static.
The next decade will be decisive. Either Israel finds a way to integrate its Haredi population into the economy and national life, or the social contract fractures. There's no guarantee which way it goes.
If this episode made you think differently about a group you thought you understood, leave a review and share it with someone who needs to hear it. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the early 1500s, a Spanish missionary in Suriname documented an axolotl in a manuscript about New World fauna, noting that the creature could regrow its limbs, tail, and even parts of its heart and brain. But he dismissed it as a demonic illusion because no animal created by God should be able to cheat death so casually.
The man saw a miracle of biology and went straight to demons.
To be fair, if I saw something regrow its brain, I might also have questions. This has been My Weird Props. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.